You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. Are we safe yet? Today's episode considers that question in the company of writer Jeff Jensen. When Todd Haynes wrote and directed his psychological feature Safe in 1995, COVID-19 was still more than two decades away. But the source of the sickness in Safe is hard to discern. Set in 1987, the film follows Carol White, played by Julianne Moore, a suburban woman who suddenly becomes sick with a mysterious illness that she believes is caused by the environment around her. As modern medical science cannot offer a precise diagnosis, Carol decides to join a New Age desert community, accentuating her alienation from others in the process. A feminist film, a horror film of sorts, and a psychological drama, Safe is difficult to categorize in its ambiguity and multi-layered possibilities.
Jeff Jensen is a screenwriter, journalist, and author based in Lakewood, California. He started in journalism, writing for publications like Entertainment Weekly, covering television shows and film franchises, becoming the magazine's chief TV critic. His graphic novel, Green River Killer, A True Detective Story, published by Dark Horse Comics in 2011, won the Eisner for Best Reality-Based Work and was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award. Jensen was a story editor on HBO's Emmy-winning limited series Watchmen, receiving Hugo and Nebula nominations with co-writer Damon Lindelof for the episode A God Walks Into a Bar. He was an executive producer and writer on the Brad Bird film Tomorrowland and co-authored the movie's prequel novel Before Tomorrowland, Disney Publishing 2015 with Jonathan Case.
Jeff Jensen, welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you with us today.
I'm so excited to be here and to talk movies and art and this movie in particular. And it's just a great pleasure to meet you here virtually and admirers of what you guys do. So I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, we're certainly admirers of what you do, and we're delighted to be discussing Todd Haynes's Safe today. Maybe we could just get started by you telling us what the film means to you and how you came to the film.
Well, Safe means so many things and so much to me. I think it's a movie that means so much to many more people, probably even more than me and the life experience I bring to it. But this was a movie that came out in 1995, and it was kind of a milestone movie for me in terms of my emerging appreciation and education about the cinema as a big, varied, eclectic art form and the different kinds of voices that could be in it and participate in it and different ways to tell stories. I was 25 at the time. I was probably at the peak of sort of like a real growth. My first act of my life as a taking cinema seriously and the kinds of things that I wanted from movies and from that really kind of began for me when I was 17. And then we get to 25 and this movie means something to me because I think that I was very enamored at that time by movies that certainly stimulate the intellect, right? And movies of a certain kind of formal quality. I was very attracted to the films of Kubrick and Lynch and Michael Mann. And these are, you know, big widescreen, static shot, long take, intellectual filmmakers. And then who were often accused of irony or being emotionally chilly. But to be of a certain age at that time, coming of age on movies, that was actually like a cool thing to be interested in. Like I liked the films of Kubrick and Lynch for their alleged irony and emotional chilliness. And then I was also kind of like really into kind of like the American independent cinema of the time of Tarantino, that's kind of operating again on a kind of a, you know, a wild, outrageous, darkly comic, very deconstructionist, arguably nihilistic place. And where those two kind of, all of those filmmakers and themes overlap is this sense of irony. Enter Safe in 1995, which was a movie experience I was just not prepared for. It was I was familiar with Todd Haynes as the filmmaker behind Poison, which is a landmark of independent cinema, and his sort of cult film, which I still haven't seen, Superstar, a sort of biopic of Karen Carpenter using Barbie dolls. And that was sort of like, for the most part, his filmography of that time. And with Safe, you know, it got a 4-star review in my local newspaper. It's the movie of the week. I'm gonna go see it. And I go see it, and I see a film that in some ways really conformed to a lot of the things that I like from movies or were jazzing me at that time about movies. This is a film that is very indebted to Kubrick. It's very indebted to a certain kind of like museum art house cinema. And Lynch, and so, you know, long static shots and symmetrical compositions with a lot of negative space. It's a movie that is very much drawing your attention to how characters live within their environment, but you're also kind of very much aware that you're watching a movie too. So there's this kind of meta experience, right? But it does something to me that completely changes the way that makes me now then go back and rewatch a lot of the other movies that I thought that I loved and thought I understood, but appreciated them differently, which is that it really is a lean in movie, right? It like, you know, you're trying to make sense of this character, Carol, played by Julianne Moore, and her breakout star making performance. And she's such at a remove from you, in the movie, given the composition or whatever, but her performance is so intriguing, you have to empathetically engage her. And so, from just a movie going perspective for me, and it builds to this absolutely devastating, amazing ending where she looks at herself in the mirror and the way that Todd Haynes stages it. She's walking up to the camera and talking to us and looking at us directly and saying, like, I love you. I love you. I love you. And it is both like moving and terrifying and uncomfortable and all of that. And it's a movie that got me asking this question: what if all of these sort of allegedly emotionally chilly styles of filmmaking, what if all of this irony isn't ironic at all? It isn't chilly at all. These are movies that are daring you to are daring you to engage the screen and care more empathetically and bring your humanity to the screen. So it was a reframing movie for me as an immature 25-year-old dude. To kind of revisit the movies that I love that stimulated my brain and ask questions like, what if David Lynch actually loves Dorothy Valens and Blue Velvet? He's not making fun of her suffering, you know? What if Kubrick actually cares about his characters and humanity? Like, how might that reach way that you read the film? So it was a very important film for me. At that time, it has stuck with me in so many ways. It's a very humanizing film that changes what I want from movies and how I look at movies. And it's a movie of its time, very 90s independent cinema, about a moment of time. The movie is set in 1987 at the peak of, you know, Reagan Bush conservative moment and at the peak of the AIDS crisis. And the movie's an allegory for that. But it's proven to be an incredibly resonant movie because it's a movie about how we relate to our environment. It's a movie about pandemic. It's a movie about pandemic culture. It's a movie about our declining environment. It's a movie that asks, what's our relationship to our artificial spaces and natural spaces at a time that we've turned our backs to nature and we're very screen-facing people. It's a movie of the 90s and it's a movie of right now. It's funny watching the movie and watching these scenes of movies with people with oxygen masks or just like protective masks and go, this movie just looks like a low budget movie that was shot just last week in LA, you know? So anyway, that's a long answer to the question, but that's why Todd Haynes is safe is both a kind of like for me, a Rosetta Stone moment that unlocked a lot of other cinema for me. And if I could just say one last thing, it's a movie that my feelings about what I get out of it has changed over time. It's what it meant to me as a young man at 25. It's a movie that certainly speaks to our condition now. And then as someone who's now actually gone through illness, and cancer, and watching the movie again this week for the first time since dealing with that illness, my gosh, I just related to it so differently. And the things that this movie says about how what our culture messages to people with illness, the hardship of illness, but the opportunity of illness for rethinking your life. Haynes often says about Carol and this movie is that this illness that she suffers is both the worst thing that's happened to her and the best thing that's happened to her. And there's a way in which that is true that I've experienced illness. I never had an illness that left me in constant debilitating pain. So I want to be very respectful for the people who have that. But anyway, this is an odd movie that has profound depth in a way that I keep on returning to over and over again.
Oh, it's so rich. You've touched on so many points that we were really hoping to discuss. So it's hard to know where to begin because there are so many layers. But I wonder if I might just start with something that I found very interesting in what you said about the question of empathy and the fact that there is a female protagonist in this film who really carries the film, the character of Carol. And it struck me as very interesting that you were watching this first as a 25-year-old male and that your own work carries such strong feminist tones. And I'm thinking about how that might have impacted you because recently I was reading empathy studies that discussed how, in literature, for example, studies show that young men don't really like generally to read female characters, but young women will read across the gender spectrum. So I found that very striking, what you said.
Well, I would have to say that a lot of that begins with this film. I mean, you're absolutely right. This character of Carol, it's the story of someone who is going through an awakening, even as it asks whether or not she has everything that she needs internally. To kind of facilitate nurture that awakening and hopefully she'll acquire that. This is a movie also about the limits of language and limits of maturity at any one time. There was something about maybe finding Carol in this moment of her life and her journey and her awakening, and then I'm capturing my imagination is captured for her internal experience that now I'm trying to understand other people outside of me across different sexualities and genders differently. I don't know, her messy awakening of empathy becomes my messy awakening in mid-90s as a 20-something kind of like clueless young man who actually wants to be in relationships with people and wants to know what it means to love other people well. That's another sub theme of this movie is how do we love each other, not necessarily romantically, but like what does it mean to really love and care about another person? I think that movie catalyzes that interest in me and wanting to mature in that level. And that begins with understanding experiences that are not mine. Todd Haynes's movies, both beginning with Poison and Safe, kind of really informed and challenged me as like a cis guy who needs to understand and like love my like LGBTQ plus neighbors better, but also understand women better. So, just like the, so in terms of like I love how you've made a connection between safe and better angels, and I'm trying to like actually now connect the dots there. I would say that beginning from that period of time, though, like a lot of stories that are very female centric become very interesting to me. So I was a huge fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for example, during the right. So during the 90s, so that's capturing my imagination and the work that they did on that film. And then kind of like Julianne Moore's character, another amazing movie that means a lot to me, another Todd Haynes film, Fall from Heaven, Julianne Moore. So like I really do become very interested in like and I'm still learning more about feminism. I've always also equally been my mom's a strong woman. I've always been attracted to strong women. I've always been intrigued by that. I'm thankfully married to an amazing woman, like strong woman. So like so just kind of like their experiences through life. That's yeah, definitely like being, being in my mid 20s in the 1990s was just a very personally rich time. Todd, the safe plays a role in that. A lot of other things that are happening in my life play a role from that, and I feel like I'm losing a little bit of narcissism and solipsism and caring more about others and wanting to know about more others in a deeper way. And this movie played a huge role in that. And I think makes me capable of certainly curious to do the work that I've done and hopefully have some degree of success at it. If I can make one more shout out here, which is that, my father is so I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and my father was a is or was he's still with us. He's a retired police detective, and his big claim to fame was that he was the chief detective on the Green River Killer murders in Seattle, a serial killer who preyed on women. And I wrote a graphic novel about my dad's work on that too. And I would say that was an incredibly formative experience for me. The book is certainly more about my dad, but to engage that material, you have to suddenly acquire an empathetic imagination for women. And so that's another, we're connecting dots between Safe and my work. It does go through my dad a little bit, yeah.
But this is really interesting because the process of being a detective as well as the process of being a writer is about being able to put oneself into someone else's shoes. It's
That's
about
right.
understanding the world from their perspective. And that's interesting in a relationship to what you said before concerning the way the films of Kubrick and Hitchcock have been understood, because I think that for a long time they've been misread. That people thought there was a lot of irony, especially with Lynch, when he was totally sincere.
Yes.
I don't know what you think about this link between the importance of. I mean, I read an article recently in which they describe his work as postmodern, and I don't think he's postmodern at all. I mean, there is no irony with Lynch. I mean, he really has a vision of his, and he's very yes. There's a lot of sincerity about his description of the world. So how do you connect this with Safe and the sort of reading that the work helped you develop in relationship with Lynch and with your relationship with other people?
Right. Yeah, I mean, to be a David Lynch fan in the 1980s, you can't help. Like, first of all, you're probably seeing the world in a slightly different way that's outside of the mainstream, right? And in ways that are eerily and uncomfortably resonant today, the 80s were a time of a great, in America, there was a nostalgia for the 50s and Americana and a kind of nationalism and patriotism that that you know the right was kind of promoting and centering. And so artists like Lynch and many others who are now working in kind of like outside of the mainstream are certainly like challenging that and questioning that. And irony was part of that toolkit, right? Like, using the iconography of America and then setting it within genre or genre stories with a certain edge to them. And now we're critiquing them and subverting them and we're you these movies are very political, right? And that was just we're talking about just a, we're talking about Lynch, but we're seeing this kind of pop off all over pop culture in the 80s and other things. Like one of the great irreverent, subversive, ironic texts of the 80s is The Simpsons, the animated cartoon. So to be a kid, at least, so being a teenager coming of age in the 80s, which is steeped in nostalgia, but with this questioning spirit by some of our kind of like counterculture artists, it was very natural to kind of often read the films of, say, Lynch, especially something like Blue Velvet, or like, say, the pilot of Twin Peaks, or even the utter like nihilistic outrageousness of Wild at Heart as kind of being ironic, right? And so for some critics, like Roger Ebert, who has an incredibly empathetic relationship with the screen, but is also like reviewing movies in a place and time and probably is influenced by culture. I don't want to speak for Roger. I'm no some no no, no I love Roger Ebert's criticism, very important to me, but a world famous critic and did not like much of Lynch early on. So he's engaging a movie like Blue Velvet and seeing the violence and degradation that is being done with Dorothy Valens. And his heart is breaking for her, but he sees her trapped in a movie that's making fun of her, like whatever he and I think that like I think and so the connection that, so and like well, let me backtrack a little bit. I got to admit, I'm caught up in this too. Like Roger, yeah, you're right. This is kind of ironic. He is making fun of kind of the extreme suffering of people. And for some reason, as me wanting to be a hipster ironist, I kind of like it. I remember seeing Blue Velvet 2 years after it came out in the Village in New York, with a bunch of Lynch fans who had a kind of a similar relationship to David Lynch at the time. And watching Blue Velvet was really interesting because for all of us, it was a nonstop laugh riot. I mean, like we're laughing at all of its like faux earnestness or what we thought was that, and subversiveness and seeing outrageous depictions of suffering on screen and having no other capacity than just to laugh at it, right? So that's who I am rolling into Safe. And Safe seemingly is engaged in certain kind of techniques that we can and filmmaking styles that we see in Lynch films or in Kubrick films, the same kind of distance and remove and paying attention to characters and space. What I'm just trying to own is where that movie landed in me in my time. If I'd seen that movie, if that movie had come out the year after like Blue Velvet, or if I saw it the weekend after Blue Velvet, I probably would have related to it as, oh, Todd Haynes, you're so ironic. Or kind of like have a more judgy relationship to this central character of Carol on the screen. But I was a different person, or I was ready for something like this at 25. And like to really make sense of this character, you really have this is a movie that makes you work. So you got to like lean into it and like, what is she going through? You have to start asking yourself these questions. And then, and if you're willing to do that, Julianne Moore's performance gives you that, and Todd Haynes is giving you ideas to think about, and it brings you up to that moment where she's looking right at us, and a movie is asking us to love her and love it and rethink your relationship to your world in those terms. Just sent me right back to Blue Velvet and go, no, like Dorothy Valens, like my God, what's happening? Like, this isn't an ironic text. This is a sincere, he's like, there is evil in the world, you know, like Jeffrey Beaumont. Why are there people like Frank in the world? That's that you can laugh at that. Lynch is asking that seriously. Like, why are there people like Frank in the world? And why does he do things like this to Dorothy Valens? Like, I don't know. It was reframing, and like it made me go back to the pilot of Twin Peaks and the great moment when Leland Palmer is on the phone with his wife, Vera, and Sheriff Truman is driving up to the lodge, and he's putting things together that Laura is dead, and Sarah is like Leland, what's going on? What's going on? And then she just starts having this, we follow the camera down the phone cord up to Sarah Palmer as she's just like wailing and wailing and wailing. And it was funny at that time, like, you know, Grace Zabriskie, this actress, one of the great underrated American actresses, but she's just having this full-on emotive moment. Watching that in the 80s is something you think that like this is like funny, ironic. Now watching it again, it's heartbreaking. So I hope that makes sense. Like Todd Haynes is like working in almost some similar styles and modes. Similar kind of questioning of our world kind of things gives me a character that captures my imagination for her experience and empathy. And then it gets me asking, have I been watching the films that I've loved wrong for a long time? You know, I know a critic that you like, Matt Zollerseits, like wonderful guy, but he wrote a great essay when Twin Peaks The Return came out about how Twin Peaks was never really about its mysteries. It was about its it, and I mean, you can enjoy it for its mysteries, but it's a movie about grief, and it's a show in which you have to take its emotions seriously. And I couldn't agree more. And I think, but it was Todd Haynes's Safe that taught me to do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's so interesting what you're saying, you know, this relationship about kind of backtracking a bit, because one of the most curious aspects of Safe for me is the fact that it's a film made in 1995, but it's set in 1987. So less than 10 years earlier, and yet there's a bit of distance. And at the same time, if you think about things like the AIDS crisis and where we were in 1995, people are still processing losses. HIV treatments have improved, so there's a bit less death, but it's still very fresh. And in a similar way, I imagine we'll be processing the pandemic that we've just lived through, you know, for years to come. We'll be thinking about that with a kind of pandemic gaze. So I'm just curious what you think about this very interesting relationship to set a film, you know, just a few years earlier, but what that does in terms of how we see the film and how we might place ourselves in that time.
And if I may add a little something, watching the film, I had the feeling to watch some sort of retro-futuristic post-apocalyptic film. I think an element of science fiction there. You don't exactly know where you are in time. That's perhaps why it's still so relevant today and was able to resonate so well with the pandemic, because even though it's set in 1987 but shot in 1995, it's a film of every single year. I mean, it could depict any year.
Yeah, let me. I'll address both of those things, Frank. I'll take your point first there, because, yeah, like so, Haynes has said that among the aesthetic touchstones that he drew on to make this film was, of all things, Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey, but you can see why. Like, because one of the central themes of that movie is how we relate to our environments, right? So whether it's the opening sequence of these proto-humans, dealing with the wasteland of their kind of like their drought-ravaged like place in the world, to by the last act of the film where we're following these astronauts. In their spaceship, in this completely mediated environment where they are all they have to do is they're running on their treadmills, they're eating their processed food, they're getting fake suntans and watching screens. Kubrick is doing something really kind of like fascinating in this moment, which is like, yes, he's taking seriously what space travel might be like and how you would like spend these long times in space and these kinds of spaces, but he's also kind of satirizing like modern life, right? And what's happening to our humanity when we are like become when we turn our backs on nature and we become like people living within these completely mediated spaces. And relating to our machines and giving up control of our lives to our supercomputers, right? In the same way, there is elements of like the way that Haine shoots Los Angeles, these outposts of humanity where Carol and her husband live in a little gated community in sort of desert wasteland hills of LA. You can easily imagine these being little outposts of, space station outposts on a desert planet. And then Carol goes to Renwood, this retreat center somewhere in the Southwest, maybe Arizona, maybe another part of California. But this too is a weird wasteland environment. And then her final act, I mean, retreating from both the modern world of LA to the nature, the desert beauty and toughness of the Southwest, and retreating into this little bulbous ceramic yurt that looks like, one of the pods from Kubrick's, like from one of the spaceship pods in 2001, and she's living in there. There is a sci-fi film. There's the synth score. Of the movie kind of like has this sort of like futurism too. It's like a yes. And then to your other question, if there was ever an opportunity to talk with Todd about this film, asking him as someone for whom who experienced the AIDS crisis, and like people he knew were suffering and dying from AIDS. I wonder if he and his collaborators could have made this film in like 1988 or 1989. And so there is an argument to be made that it is an interesting choice to make a film in 1995, reflecting on a moment that's just 8 years past. But yeah, you start seeing by 95. I mean, by 1987, the AIDS crisis had as was in full effect, and so certain narratives and understandings of that are already becoming fully developed strategies for dealing with it medically, spiritually, and are changing. So but then by 1995, we know so much more, right? And so maybe for him and his collaborators, it isn't until it was interesting how we got into it, because if I believe the origin story was that in the early 90s, he and some of his collaborators became very fascinated with the idea of environmental illnesses and how they related to immune deficiency disorders, of which AIDS, of course, is one. And so he started seeing this sort of like interesting relationship where AIDS is participating in a larger family of illnesses with different causes, but can be kind of but and it can be narrated in different ways, but he's now seeing it, all these other illnesses that are real and real things. And he kind of happens on that metaphor of a person who's literally allergic to their world, allergic to their culture, not just environment, and making that link to AIDS and saying, hey, I can actually tell a really compelling story about the AIDS crisis through the metaphor of a real thing, environmental illness. I'm just saying that, like, it's interesting how I think he needed that years of distance and those additional pieces of information to inform this great piece of reflection on a very confusing, like, the plague years of HIV and AIDS, and to make sense of it. Seriously, and conversely, to kind of bring us to the present, I do wonder if in the next 10 years, if not sooner, we're going to actually see a lot of art that reflects upon the COVID-like pandemic with a great deal of thoughtfulness that maybe eludes us right now, certainly, like a couple years ago, eludes us. Oh, and another way in which the movie contains some really the value of reflection, right? The cult of Renwood. I like, so Julianne Moore's character, Carol, in this movie gets sick, and then she finds out about a retreat center where people go who are suffering from environmental illness, and they can stay there temporarily, they could stay long term. And there's a guy who runs it. And he has what emerges over time, at longer she stays, is that this guy has this really interesting philosophy about that, seemingly rooted in sort of new agey ideas or countercultural ideas or sort of environmentally conscious ideas. You're tempted to say that it's a kind of like a communal collectivist ethos, where we just have to help each other through it. But the deeper we get into it, the more this ethos ends up revealing that it's just as hyper individualistic and conservative, and as the kind of like American ethos that Haynes is criticizing here, like, you are responsible for your illness. If only you loved yourself more, you could transcend, and you could transcend pain and suffering, and you can be, you could be immune to the slings and arrows of the world, and it's all on you. It's your fault. And what Haynes has talked about is that this was the messaging to gay people during the 80s about the AIDS crisis, right? And it's the whole spirit, the corrupt, the whole toxic spirit of 80s conservatism. That's a bit of reflection that you probably can't do in the moment. This guy being able to reflect upon, a lot of gay men were told during the 80s that if you just loved yourself better, you could handle AIDS better. And this is Haynes reflecting on all of this cultural messaging, the ethos of the conservative times, the stinking thinking that was promoted to his community, and just asking serious questions about it, interrogating it. So Safe just is such a rich film because, yeah, it's an allegory for AIDS, it's an allegory for how we relate to our material world. It's a critique of a larger cultural moment of conservatism. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I love coming back to it, because it's so much there.
And I would argue that it is fundamentally a film about alienation, about being alienated from yourself, and about alienated from the community in which you live. And it seems to me that the two parts of the film, because it's basically split in two, the one in the Los Angeles community that looks like basically the perfect world of the Avon woman from Edward Scissorhands, with the same color scheme. And the second part in the desert are two sorts of prisons of sorts for her, aren't they?
And I agree. I mean, it is this great tale and sobering tale of someone who probably who the way I kind of make sense of Carol based on how Todd tells this story is that she's very much a product of her culture, And so there is a fundamental shallowness to her, but there is a deep there, but there is someone in there. There, or maybe there's just something about about humanity in general and our humanity where you can't be completely like, robbed of it. Despite the conditioning forces of our world that make you make us superficial. So there is something about her on a real gut level that I think that she knows that there is some kind of alienation from the world. This is my life and this is my existence, and I've kind of given myself over to it. But on some level that I can't even express, that I only maybe don't even allow myself to think about, there's something wrong with the way that we're living. I am not meant for this. We are not designed for this. This is not an optimal way of living that is like teasing out and helping us be fully realized human beings. And the journey that she then goes on in this movie as she starts questioning some things, and then she starts getting sick, environmentally, one of the great early moments of the movie is that she's driving down, I believe it's Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. I know this part of town very well, driving toward the 405 on Wilshire, and she gets stuck behind a truck that is poking, carbon monoxide is coming into her car, and she's coughing, coughing, coughing. But what's really interesting about the movie that he does in these scenes is she's also talking, listening to news radio that's very much about the socio-political, religious thing of the moment. There's so much advertising outside of the car on Wilshire Boulevard, and I forget if she's just come back from getting her hair permed. I'm not sure. I forget. But you can read this movie in many ways. Is she gagging on the monoxide? Is she gagging on her culture? So this is a person who is kind of like senses on some level that like the world is not wrong and or not right, and it's toxic. And as the more she commits to this sort of journey of sickness, the more alienated she becomes from everything. And this is where now the formal qualities of the movie really kind of bring this out, where just like again, like she's often like deep in a frame, surrounded by her world or the smallest thing in the frame, and she's like swallowed up by like living rooms and her and houses and stuff like that. She's just being, yeah, she's kind of lost in these spaces, and you get the sense profoundly alienated from them, certainly having hostile reactions to that. And yeah, in the second half of the film, you think that she's kind of like found an oasis, right? Oh, from the modern world and all of its contaminants and pollutants. But then, she goes for these long walks and finds out that they're surrounded by a highway and the cars are rumbling down the road and kicking out exhaust. But then she kind of, I think, ends up finding out that, well, there are other conditioning agents that contaminate us in our world, and they're called human beings. And like, and so like, is the culture, the self-help culture of Renwood, really what favors is it doing to her, and for her, like, it's, yeah, like, and so she becomes like, the choice to want to live in that sort of hermetically sealed yurt at the end. I mean, now she's retreating from like the nature around her and from even the other people around her that are going through a similar journey as her. Like, where is she going to end up? Like, the thing about the movie at the end, you get to the end and you kind of easily imagine a version where maybe she, we're leaving her at a messy moment of awakening. And so maybe she continues to grow in a messy way, as we all do, right? Or does she continue this downward spiral of increasing isolation and disconnection from other people? Like, It's the ultimate existential cliffhanger
I think it relates a lot to what you were saying earlier concerning the fact that the film doesn't give you necessarily all the answers, that
ending.
you need to be active as a viewer in order
Yes.
to analyze it. And you become part of the movie in a sense as
Yeah.
someone watching it. And but to come back to that final scene, could not we also see a certain level of narcissism in this relationship to the mirror? I mean, that reminded me a lot about what's happening to Audrey Horne too, in the third season of Twin Peaks. I think that there's also a possible link there, isn't there?
Yeah. It's part of what makes that final scene so complicated, right? And so deliciously complicated and so heartbreaking. People for many years have debated the ending of that movie of Safe and asked, is this a happy ending? Is this a horror movie ending? Like, what is she committing to herself here? Like, yeah, like she's engaging a reflection of herself. And she's been told earlier in the movie by other people at Renwood that when they found themselves in these sort of crippling moments of self-doubt about the process or dealing with anxiety or all sorts of other things related both to the process, but their own illness. She's told by this one person, I looked at myself in the mirror and just told, I had to tell myself, like, I love you. I love you. I love you. And so, in this moment where she's looking at the mirror and saying this to herself while sealed up in this, in this, again, this ceramic yurt, you're left to kind of wonder, like whether you're left to ask questions about the process that she's beginning here, and whether or not this kind of self-love does any good or ends up like locking her more herself up more, where the only company that she can keep is herself, and she's cut off from the world with only her reflection for company, right? And I think that when Haynes has talked about the philosophy of the film, I don't want to speak for him, but so I think how I'm making sense of things, he was saying that, this was one of the great disappointments of some of the counterculture movements that moved out of the 60s and 70s to question, certain ideologies of the time, which was that this kind of like, so the whole idea of self-care is actually rooted in a very Marxist idea of taking care of yourself so that you have internal resources to care about the world and other people. And where that movement gets off track is that it ends up becoming just very vain and narcissistic. It's, I mean, we're just kind of working on ourself and feeling good about ourselves and feeling good about our bodies, and ends up becoming very narcissistic and very vain. And there's a degree to which Safe kind of like pokes at this, right? Because one of like Carol's favorite pastimes is going to sort of like the aerobics dance class and kind of poking at the fitness craze of the 80s. That is kind of more as an end. Hey, there's nothing wrong with being physically fit. I want to be very clear about that. But I think that he's again poking at these things and questioning certain things. So yeah, like is you know, so on one level, Carol leaving Carol at this place where all she's doing is just relating to her image that she sees in the mirror and saying, I love you. Like, is this a really good therapy for her? But it also creates, ironically, I don't know, like this other kind of confrontation, because though we get both of these meanings at once, right? We get what we just talked about, but then we get these, we get these shots that were in back of her, so we know that she's talking to her reflection, right? But otherwise, we're in the mirror and she's talking to us. And
Mm-hmm.
in some ways, Haynes is now kind of like speaking back to and correcting the self-help ideologies of the time. If what we are to say from another point of view is that self-help is in service of gathering resources for ourselves so that we can love other people, where, well, here's Julianne Moore, who's just gone on this incredibly intense journey. And she's standing right in front of us, and the film is saying to us, outward facing to us, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's almost like Haynes is doing two things at once. He's critiquing self-help, and then he's correcting like self-help in the same time, if that makes sense.
You could even argue that she is a reflection of us, that
Yes.
she's not the one looking into the mirror, but that we are the ones looking at ourselves in the mirror of the screen, of the cinema screen, and that she represents perhaps what is right or what is wrong about our society, about us.
Yes. No, absolutely. That's beautiful. And like let's be even like and at the end, we keep on focusing on what she says, but she says, I love you, and then she says nothing, and we hold on her. She's waiting for a response, right? The movie is waiting for the response. The world is waiting for a response from us. Like that's, like, and then cut to black, and you're like, oh, like it literally takes your breath away. That cuts, like to the end. At least for me, it was like you're kind of with her in this, and like you're crying. You're kind of like, what's happening? Like it's kind of scary. I keep on waiting in that moment for like something to crawl into frame and back, or like I'm waiting for the horror movie of this scary movie in a way, this existential horror film to kind of like go full horror. Or for like so, for something to break in Julianne Moore's face, that like whatever, but it doesn't happen. But I love that she says something to us, and then there's that pause as if it's like the movie leaves us in a place of responding. How do we respond to a movie like Safe, not just in making art, but just being a human being in the world? I love this movie because in part because like I love how Haynes uses technique and story and characters to express something about the world and engage the world and engage us, the viewer, and ask for something in return, a response. I mean, that he's certainly not the first one to ever do that. In my own like cinematic appreciation, it was like just a flashpoint of that kind of art making for me.
I'm really fascinated by mirror moments in film, and there are so many different possibilities, but it seems to me that this one is really striking in the sense that it both capitalizes on the mirror as something that's often used to take us back to the past, which this film is doing, traveling back to a time prior to the one that we're in now, or even when the film premiered in 95. And at the same time, the mirror as a site of illusion. And I'm thinking a lot about the kind of unreliable narration that Haynes has spoken about in relationship to Greg, who runs the wellness center, and the fact that Haynes thought about, placing a certain trust in him as a gay man with AIDS, and that would gain our confidence as a viewer. And then it gets turned on its head when we see that one moment, his mansion on the hilltop, and that's the aha. And I'm just wondering what you think about this concept of narration and these very tiny moments that actually really shift very strongly our perception in the film of a person, a situation.
I love little moments like that. I love the way in which, in the Renwood scenes, the second half of the movie, it kind of begins kind of conspicuously with a moment that might be canal, like you might think of it as kind of like an omen, right? Because like Julianne Moore is arriving by taxi, and all of a sudden you hear a woman start screaming like stop, stop, turn around. And in the context of the story, it's like In the context of the story, it's because, well, this gas guzzling like cab is now spewing all of this like carbon monoxide across this sanctuary that's supposed to be like, pollution free. But it's our first sign in this movie that like appearances are not what it seems, and there's going to be limits to what we can find here in terms of healing and understanding, and that in fact it might end up being enemies to that process. And so the way that, he very deliberately and very cunningly, Todd Haynes, kind of like, yeah, as you kind of said, he kind of has said that he cast, like, it's the first time that we see a person of color in this movie. Julianne Moore's character is just like, she lives in a very, very white world. And one of the first characters that she gets is like, is she encounters is a person of color. And then the leader of Wrenwood it ha has AIDS, and we are left to assume that he is a gay man. And so it was interesting how he has said, yeah, right, like all of these characters, like given what the movie is setting you up for, like you would then think, given the politics of the movie, these people are the good guys. And they turn out to be as complicated and possibly. Maybe they have a compass that's pointing them in the right direction, but they're taking some really off-roads ways that might lead to dead ends to get there, right? And it's just kind of like, Wrenwood is held out as this place of great hope for her, to give her and develop the resources that she needs to re-engage life. But it ends up just kind of being another complicated place with its own toxicities to dodge and to filter. And there's, I think he's also said about the movie is that it's a movie in which there's no escape, right? So it's just like, it's like LA, I gotta get out. Wrenwood, that's my salvation. I go to Wrenwood. This is gonna be it, this, right? This is how life should be lived in this kind of collectivist commune, organized self-help. Well, maybe not. Maybe the people are incredibly flawed. Maybe it's not there. And so now I'm just going to retreat to my little ceramic yurt and like hang out with my reflection for the rest of my life. Well, there's no escape from that either. Like, well, where's that going to lead? So, yeah.
To a certain extent, it seems to me that that mirror at the end can also be seen somehow between the two parts of the film. That the second part of the film is just the inverted mirror image of the first part of the film, and that jives with what you were saying concerning this idea of no escape.
That's right. Yeah, very much so. That was something I was got really in touch with watching this movie again, is that really is a movie with two halves. And how they're kind of set up to be in dialogue with each other, and one is allegedly the remedy for the other, and then you're kind of like catching up to. No, this place is wherever human people are going to form a culture. It's going to be complicated. There are going to be limits, and it could be toxic. And then there are all these hints of like corruption and hypocrisy. Like they go for that stroll, and they see that the Wrenwood leader has that big house on the hill. And like, where's all this money that we're paying for our healing really going in service to what? Like, and it's just, and it's, it's like, there's no conversation about the house on the hill, right? It's, the great Zan character actor Xander Berkeley, who plays like Carol's husband, is like, I think that I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but they're strolling him through the desert landscape, and oh, who lives up there? Oh, it's, the guy who runs this place. Oh, okay. And like, and then just lets that kind of like detonate in your brain and think about for a while. It's how the movie kind of treats a lot of things, and I love stuff like that.
And this is slightly off topic, but for me, there was a small delight in the cameo appearance of Jessica Harper in the film, whom at that time we hadn't seen on screen in so long. I think for fans of cult cinema who love Phantom of the Paradise or Suspiria, it was so great to see her as a resident at Redwood.
Yes, yeah. I love these little castings, and I love like I love reading some of that kind of behind the scenes story of Haynes, bringing in all sorts of influences and people that he's admired. But I love like how I don't know how to pronounce his last name. The cinematographer of the movie, Alex, I wish I could pronounce his last name. He's a Russian like filmmaker and director of photography. But he wanted this guy to do the cinematography of this movie after having seen Poltergeist 3. And he just like, whatever you want to say about that movie, he really liked the way that he shot Poltergeist 3. And I just love how eclectic, like Todd Haynes's references are. He speaks the language of Kubrick and Antonioni, and then like Poltergeist 3 and body horror movies and stuff like that. So yeah.
There's one moment in the film that you have spoken briefly about. It's the moment in the gym when they're doing aerobics. And there's one line that she says, which I find very interesting. She says, "I don't sweat."
Oh, yes.
That's so
Yes, I
important, I
don't
think,
sweat.
isn't it? About not processing toxins.
Yes. It's a I that grabbed my attention too, and I kept on thinking, like, now that I know what this movie is about, you go through it and then you kind of see these little character moments, these little details that probably went right over at least my head upon whatever. But like, yeah, this is a movie about like, yeah, someone who is being poisoned by her environment in many ways, literal and metaphorical, and she is compromised by perhaps by a condition that she doesn't have healthy means to like get rid of these toxins. The movie asks, then uses that as a metaphor to ask, well, what would be what does our culture need? What do we need to like adequately process the toxins of our culture? But yes, I latched on that too. Lots of little moments, like one of the very first lines in the movie. The movie opens up right with this Carol and her husband are driving home from some event out, maybe a dinner with like clients, his clients or whatever. But we don't know that. The camera is on the dashboard of this car, and we're driving through the streets of this housing development up in like the Fox Hills area, the desert hills of Los Angeles. And like, talk about reflections, right? We see the reflections of a world, like, reflected in the front of the car, of this well-polished car, and all of that. And it drives right up into like the garage, and the synth score. I got Mulholland Drive vibes, that whole beginning of the film of Lynch's Mulholland Drive, where we're in that limo snaking up Mulholland Drive and the synth score. And I'm like, oh, like Todd Haynes kind of beat Lynch to this by about like, 3 years. But then we go right into the driveway, and then they get out. And she says, oh, it's a little chilly in here. And I'm like, oh, you have no idea how chilly things are about to get. But yeah, and like lots of lines that become very loaded and speak to her, like the coldness of her marriage, the inert, the frozen and inert person that's inside her. Like to like a person who doesn't sweat, what do all these things
Her
mean?
name is White, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
Her name is White.
Oh, that's right. Carol White. Yes, it's one of the most blunt on the nose things about the
Well, our hour is almost to an end, and it's been so lovely speaking with you. And before we conclude, we always love to finish with the question, is there something you wish we had asked that we didn't? About safe.
Well, no, I hope this conversation captures people's imagination for the movie and gets them to see it. It's so worth seeing. Again, it's a movie, like we talked a lot about its place in movie culture, and late 20th century culture, and certainly as it pertains to shared passions here, like Lynch. But it's a movie that really speaks to where you're, like all of us right now, on a human level, on a global level. And it really is a movie for now. And but I've really loved our conversation. I mean, like I'm grateful to have, it's a movie that, like not a lot of people saw. I mean, like I think read that it only did like did you know was made for $1 million, and I think it only grossed like $500,000 in the theater. It was certainly not a movie that ran anywhere outside like your local art house theater, if you have a local art house theater that's adjacent to you. So it's one of the I know it's a movie that has been written about more recently. I think that the New Yorker ran a very nice piece about it, and a really good piece about it, in 2020 as pandemic culture was exploding around us. And I really appreciated that article about it at the time. That's something, if you want to read about the film, like Google that and with the New Yorker. There's a really wonderful, you could Google like a great interview with Todd Haynes about the movie that the film critic Amy Taubin did, many years ago. And that's really good. But yeah, I think we covered it all. There's probably so much more to say. But I'm grateful for what we talked about.
Oh, great. And maybe is there anything you'd like to tell us about your creative work? I know we've talked about Better Angels, the graphic novel. Is there anything else you'd like viewers to, or listeners, excuse me, to know about?
Yeah, I mean, there are things that I'm in the midst of working on that fall under the category of not my project, someone else's. So it's hard to talk about like my current Hollywood work. But yeah, like my graphic novels, Better Angels, about the first female American private detective, and a graphic novel about my father, Green River Killer, a true detective story. My dad is the detective, not the killer. And television shows I've worked on, most notably HBO's Watchmen, that I'm very proud of. So yeah, that's the and I also helped write a movie called Tomorrowland with George Clooney from about 10 years ago, and I'm very proud of that too. So yeah.
Absolutely. Well deservedly. So, yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jeff. It was wonderful to chat with you about SAFE tonight, our time, and I guess this morning, your time.
And thank you for all your creative work as well. You've done so much, and we are grateful for it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Great talking with you guys, and love to do it again sometime.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.